Mel Frizzell, and this is The Panic Years. When I was 28, everyone around me seemed to be getting married, getting promotions, buying houses, and having babies. I was single, redundant, and living with my mum. At the time, I thought it was a private crisis. Now I understand it was just my panic years, and that is what this podcast is all about. I'm in a park. I know some people's enthusiasm for parks is wearing a little thin after the last year, and with good reason, but this is actually a very good one. There's a community gooseberry bush, a big fallen tree you can climb on, and so many bags of dog shit hanging from the trees that it looks like Christmas every day. My guest this week is the comedian, actor, screenwriter, activist, and mother, Josie Long. I was desperate to get Josie on the podcast because from Love and Adventure to Cara Josephine to Something Better to Tender, Josie's shows have been the very mirror to my panic years. Over and over again, she's put on stage and into words things that I was struggling to express at the time. And each time, she did it with joy and enthusiasm and kindness and hilarity. So it was nothing short of a pleasure to speak to my old friend about breakups, work, chaos, baby hunger, polycystic ovarian syndrome, love, time, and getting horny. Also, stick around after the interview because I'll be talking to Dr. Anita Mitra, aka the Gynae Geek, to get her expert insight into our bodies and health. How are you and how is your body?
I am all right and my body has seen better years. You know, I was thinking today, I was like, my body would be in so much better shape if anything was happening.
Yeah. If any movement were possible.
Yeah, like I'm doing yoga every day. Great. I love it. But it's not enough, is it? 15 minutes of a little stretch or whatever. It's not enough to make
I did a 15-minute home workout the other day and thought, that's hoovering what I've done. Like that's just the equivalent of hoovering and maybe hanging out the washing. So I wanted to talk to you about the panic years, partly because I feel like you witnessed mine. Also, I think there's so much of the way that you've lived your life that makes you a person that I look to for sort of comfort and advice.
That's very kind.
No, it's true. At 28, I'd say that's when it all kicked in. Mm-hmm. And I remember just feeling like I was out of sync with everyone around me, or mm-hmm. I was out of sync with the expectations I'd carried with me up until that point. Yeah. And it felt like people were starting to get married or people were starting to have babies, get pregnant, that kind of thing. And I was just in a state of complete absence or chaos. What were you doing at 28?
Until I was 29, I was in a really stable relationship and my career was really, really absolutely going out the park at that time. And I sort of felt very much on a particular trajectory. I sort of had a bit of a, I don't know what I would call it, a freak out, a breakdown. I would call it, for whatever reason, good or bad, I felt impossibly compelled to set off a bomb in my life and to change it. I felt really like there's nothing, I have no, this is out of my hands. I can't continue as I'm going, even though it was a lot of things. It was some immaturity on my part. It was a lot of unresolved things from my childhood that I hadn't really dealt with. It was fear of commitment, fear of growing older, and fear of the pressure of like what settling down meant and what having kids meant. And so I just basically at 29 was like, run for the hills.
Yeah.
And then just sort of fannied about for a long time. Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. It's like the unswervable, compelling need to create chaos in your life.
Yeah. It was like driving a truck off of a bridge. It was going at 20 miles an hour and I could have stopped it, but I couldn't stop it.
I'm just going to juggernaut into this splash. But then I think years later, and not that many years later, like 4 years later, I suddenly, with this amazing hindsight, saw that so much of that was about my fertility, and that I'd sort of, I'd felt like, okay, if I'm going to do this, I can't do it here now in this situation, meaning like with this person, with this job, in this setup. And so I don't like thinking of your fertility as a biological clock, but I do think it is a kind of mechanism by which you're propelled into making decisions.
I agree. And I also think the pressure, the way that we're made to believe that we're on the clock, the way that we're made to believe, well, you know, there's no way otherwise, you know, it does make you panic. Like it does, because you're just like, I'm running out of time. I have to make this decision. I don't know if I don't make this decision, then I'll never get the chance.
Did you have a number in your head? Like, because I remember 35, it was like traditionally when you'd become a geriatric mum, which thankfully they've dropped as a term. And my mum got the menopause at 40. Wow. So I remember thinking, I've got hard maths here, like not emotionally hard. I was like, this is rational. This is scientifically proven that at 35, my womb is just going to effectively fart out of my ass and I'm not going to be able to have a baby anymore.
Well, I'm in a weird place at the moment because I'm 38 and I want to have my second child. And obviously I had my first child by accident, which, you know, all my life since I was 19, I've been told because I have PCOS, it'd be really difficult to conceive. I'd carried that worry around. I'd assumed this trauma was on the plate for me and then got pregnant by accident, didn't have to think about it, couldn't believe that gift. And then now I'm actually trying to get pregnant. It's only been 2 months, but it's 2 months of it not happening. And I'm having the exact same thing of like, well, you're 38. If it doesn't happen by the time I'm 39, it'll never happen. It'll never happen. And it's like, or you can just try and go to the doctor and treat it as if it's a thing that you're trying to make happen. And this, as if it's a thing that is possible or not and will have to be dealt with in those terms and not some sort of mystical punishment of time, you know, that's not helpful.
Oh, yeah. Like you have made certain personal and political decisions that mean that you don't deserve a baby now, I'm afraid. That's the feeling that is sort of fed to you really implicitly by, you know, like, oh, if you want to put other things first and this isn't your entire like motivation for life, then we might just take it away from you. I hate that feeling. But you hear it in the way people talk about that they were selfish. Everyone feels like they were selfish.
But when I hear men talk about that, they're like, yeah, I wanted to be selfish. You know, that's why I had a baby at 50. I got that all out of my system. They're proud of it, you know.
I'm sorry you're feeling like that, though. It's a really hard thing because you also have this quite visceral confrontation with the fact that you're not pregnant, which I think doesn't get talked about very often.
It's so unfair that the reward for not getting pregnant is to have a period. No way. No way. It's not fair. Like, it should be that the reward for not being pregnant is like the opposite of that, like a double ovulation.
Your eyes are so bright and like your teeth have suddenly become stronger. Lovely.
This is what should happen. If you're trying to conceive, if it doesn't happen, instead of a period, you get a double ovulation and it rolls over until you get the job done. That's how it should be. It makes no sense that the body would be like, oh, did it not happen? I give up. Shouldn't give up. Should keep going. Yeah, it's also a really interesting cycle to be on time-wise, because it's like, well, I know that this time is this and that time is that, and in between this and this time, I just have to wait, and then this, you know, it's mad.
When you say you were going to carry that trauma, did you really think that you just wouldn't be able to get pregnant without in medical intervention? Were you sort of preparing yourself for that?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was told. And I know that other people with PCOS have had similar things where I was just told from the like start when I got diagnosed, oh, well, what this means is it's really difficult for you to conceive and it'd be really hard. And I just don't know if that's the case. I do know that the fertility doctors like to talk about weight a lot, but then what doctor doesn't like to talk about weight a lot? And that worries me. Because then I think, if the pandemic wasn't on, I swear to God, I would be in better shape than I am now. But if you think I'm not going to, e.g. tonight, eat a steak pie and chips, which I'm literally allergic to, and I still ate it. If you think I'm not going to do that, you don't know me.
Yeah, you've lost a cog if you think that's what's going to happen.
A cog's fallen out your ear, mate.
How old were you when you were diagnosed?
Yeah, I was 19.
Were you thinking back then, I really want to be a mum one day?
Yeah, I've always felt that.
Oh.
And my mum really did go through an intense brainwashing with me and my sister since we were babies. Like, it was always like, and when you have your own babies, and you won't know until you have your own babies, but you're not really, like, literally, you're not really a woman unless you've had your baby, you know, all this stuff. And I think, you know, obviously that's something that I've had to recalibrate against myself, but for whatever reason, it really stuck with me. And I did, I mean, I don't believe those things about women, but for myself, I desperately wanted to have kids, desperately.
I wanted to ask you about baby hunger, because I feel like it's a very particular feeling that I can't remember not having. Like, I remember even as a 7-year-old going to a barn dance and there being someone holding like a lovely chubby baby and one just moving. My mum said I moved towards it like a kind of missile.
So I think I was like that, but I think it only really kicked in weirdly after I broke up with my kind of long-term boyfriend. And when I really wasn't in appropriate relationships, then I was really like, baby, baby, baby. And I think I definitely know, you know, when somebody's really, really, that has really peaked. Like, you know, when you suddenly have a friend who's suddenly like now as a mother, a friend who's like suddenly just really interested in what it's like. And you're like, you're going to be pregnant soon, babe. you want to be pregnant. That's what's going on here.
Yeah.
Like, people suddenly be really just caring and interested about the baby. And you're like, yeah, you're having a baby. But I had a younger brother when I was 13. So I had a baby in my life when I was a teenager.
Interesting.
And that was quite exciting. And it sort of quelled a bit of like the inbuilt baby hunger because he screamed a lot.
I was going to say I had this fever, like baby fever, to make it sound like a 1950s B movie. Then when I was 20, my dad had his second family. And I remember sort of then being confronted with what that meant. Just what that meant physically and in terms of your life and schedule and ability to move through the world, and thinking, oh, because at 17, I would have 100% got pregnant if anyone had wanted to put sperm anywhere near me, for sure, desperate. And then seeing that up close, the sort of reality of babies, I was like, oh no, I think I do actually want to get a job first.
I had a thing where I was like, I can't get pregnant too soon. I can't get pregnant too soon. And then it's suddenly when I was about 32, 33, I was like, I need to get pregnant now. And it was like flipped. And then I was like, shit. And it's like now I'm like, is the window closed?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's just thinking then when you said, well, when I said I need to get, maybe I should have a job first before I get pregnant at 18. You actually had a job. Like, your career started at 15. So by the time, like, by the time people like me were thinking about having babies, you'd been working for over half your life. Like,
yeah.
Did that change? Do you think that had any effect on the way you thought about what is, I think, an incontrovertible friction between having a career and having a family?
Having a family.
Let's just be honest.
Especially, let's be real, as a woman where, for whatever reason, I mean, It still feels like society has really got its choices as to whose career will be impinged.
Yeah. Yes.
Society's got that choice. I'm not saying individuals do, because individuals are pretty cool on the whole, but society. Yeah, in some ways, I was really ready to focus on something else. And I still am. I still love the fact that at this time in my life, I don't feel myself this year, maybe last year, being able to do much wonderfully creative stuff, but I am able to parent, and that is fulfilling and creative and wonderful. And I do love that. And I do feel ready for that. I didn't feel desperate to go to overseas festivals last year. And I didn't feel heartbroken that I was missing certain things when I was in my little maternity period. Weirdly though, even at the point I got pregnant, which was at 35, I was still sort of thinking, oh no, I just really, really need to have a bit more of a foothold in this business before I have a baby. And I did really feel like, oh, perhaps I had a baby at a crucial time, meaning that certain things did or didn't happen for me. But I think maybe that would always feel the case. We are taught so much over so long, or definitely people of my generation have been taught so much over so long, that there are these horrifically high stakes and there's nothing you can do about it, and that's that, and you're to blame if you don't take advantage of it. And like, there's always so many options out there, so much more time than you think, and you can always approach it in a way that is not as high stakes and in a way that is a lot less punishing. And I think I'm just saying this to myself because I'm still now going, if you don't get pregnant by the time you're 30, no, and you can't give birth at home in a birthing pool.
But also that you're kissing goodbye to your ability to ever make meaningful work in whatever that work looks like. Just at the time when everyone tells you that your career is going to disappear, actually, you might feel incredibly mobilised and enthused and inspired. And that's another thing that people don't like to talk to you about. They talk about the fact that you're going to have to put things on hold, make enormous sacrifices, change the way you work. And actually, yes, but only because we have buggered up the way we work. And actually, if you have a bit more autonomy, which I'm very lucky to have, having a child might be really profound.
I feel a more loving and focused and attentive person because of it. I feel more confident. I feel more able to judge what is to my benefit or to my detriment, and to sort of swerve the latter. I feel like coming back to stand-up in particular, I remember I was doing a gig and someone was being disrespectful, and I just remember thinking, I gave birth to a human being. Like, I don't give a damn what you're doing. Like, I gave birth to a child. Like, this is nothing. And like, a lot of that, I do feel, I do have a better sense of perspective. And I loved writing a stand-up show when my daughter was kind of 9 months old. I loved the process. When I came back to it, nothing had changed except that I had love and enthusiasm for what I was doing after having a break. Like, it didn't suffer. I felt like proud of my show. I thought it was better than other things that I'd done, you know? Unfortunately, the comedy industry doesn't seem to quite catch up with that.
I know. Do you sometimes? I do look around and think, what is the industry that does value the parent as a employee? Like, who actually does?
Well, even nurseries, like, I suppose like, some people I know from nurseries, their kid will be in the nursery too.
I don't know if people are like, if they look at a load of CVs, they'd be like, oh, good, she's had kids, she'll be good at this job. I think maybe.
I don't know either. Are. And I've had experience of both key workers who did not have kids and key workers who had kids. So I don't know.
If we're going to talk about nurseries, here's the thing that I think is not well known enough to the detriment of people who are trying to make this decision, which is that within, I think it's just England, the average income versus the average cost of childcare means that 43% of your income is going on childcare. Which means that if you are a single parent or you are a sole earner, you are, what are you going to do? How do you survive?
And then you
on
take
that?
Into account, if you're living in London, how much rent is, you know? I think the average rent is like 60%. So that's it. That's you done.
That's it. You've got minus 3% every month. Congratulations. What do you think is the solution to that? Like, how do we make having children not financially prohibitive?
Nationalised childcare.
Thank you. I thought that's what you'd
say. What, that's what was in the Labour manifesto, wasn't it, the other year?
And it was what was in the Women's Liberation Conference in 1970. That's 40 years ago. They
don't
said,
want to drag us back to the 70s. I would love to be dragged back to the 70s. Look, no global warming, you know, David Bowie in his prime. Difficult plays on television. Oh, imagine that. You finish your day and then you sit down and watch a difficult play that you couldn't watch again.
Yeah. Having strange sexual feelings about Mark Bolan.
Oh.
Why not?
I dream of it.
Yeah. Lots of candles.
3-day working week, of course. 3-day week. I'd love to have work a 3-day week. No seatbelts. No seatbelts dragging us down.
But yeah, for like nationalised childcare, it makes everyone wealthier, it makes everyone happier, yeah. healthier.
And also it gives parents more choice as to who will work and when. Like that's, I mean, I've seen with so many friends of mine, oh, well, he earns more than me, so blah, blah, blah. And that's really harsh and very, you know, as we all know, and if you're listening to this and you don't know, allow me to teach you, childcare is harder than work. I don't care what your job is, childcare is harder than work.
Yeah, it's true.
Maybe there's three jobs that are harder. I don't know what they are. So if somebody is doing the childcare, they're working harder than you. And if somebody on top of that is doing the nights, if somebody's breastfeeding during the nights and doing the childcare,
yeah.
there is no job on earth you could be doing that is harder than that.
Yeah, if someone's life force is literally being leached out of their body at hourly intervals by someone who might die at any second.
And they're being flooded with hormones that make them insane, or at the very least, not themselves.
You've just reminded me of when I was at school, we were studying stress in psychology, I think I did psychology A-level, don't want to go on about it.
Of course you did, mate, of course you did.
And I remember
she respects the human condition.
Some friends and I, we decided as like a long-running joke to come up with the most stressful event we could think of, which was operating on a famous baby on a plane that was very hot, surrounded by naked people having sex. We were like, that would be... And I think that is more stressful than childcare.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
I've been thinking, in terms of the panic years, is what we're panicking about commitment? And if so, does that commitment panic just look different according to gender? Or are we conditioned to think about it in different ways according to the way we are sort of conditioned, gendered, our age, whatever? Because I remember when I was ploughing through fields of emotionally unavailable men, and I was being rejected and heartbroken on a sort of almost, I'd say, 7-minute basis, I remember trying to understand what their problem would be with commitment. The only way I could think about it was if someone turned around to me and said, you have to now pick the house you're going to live in for the rest of your life right now. And I'd be like, oh, I don't know. Do I want, maybe Hartlepool? Or like, maybe I should, I've never been to Bath and Maisonette, so cool. And I thought, is that the feeling? Is that what the commitment phobia is?
I do think it manifests differently along gendered lines, although obviously gender is more complicated than just like a binary, and I don't know how it affects people who sort of don't fit into that. But for me personally, like I found mine sort of related to my personal experience. So I saw my mum growing up being very unhappy in a lot of situations, feeling unfulfilled. And again, when it comes to time running out, I really remember when my mum must have been about 40, and she'd always say things like, oh, it's too late for me. So she'd be like, I always wanted to learn the piano, but it's too late for me. That was like 29 years ago. She could be a virtuosic pianist by now, you know, it's too late for me.
Or Elton John.
She'd be a fine Elton. And so that was part of it, was this feeling that like, seeing my mum as a mother, her reinforcing to me that something, once she became a mother, shut off all other possibilities. And I don't mean that as an insult to her at all, because my mum pulled off a lot of incredible things and was a wonderful mum to me, is a wonderful mum to me. But I do feel that she was wrestling with a lot of unfulfilled ambitions. And also because of the fact that like my dad kept his job and she sort of didn't, and her career was kind of put into different directions. She looked after us for 5 years or 6 years or however long. And so, you know, she had to bear the brunt of that. And then the second thing is like, as a result of that, I think I always saw life as in two phases. You had like the fun bit, and then you had sinister phase two, where you would make the wrong decision and live in misery as a trapped suburban housewife, feeling very much that you were a caged bird. Or a matinee starlet kept in a closet, you know, like, I don't know. But I was so worried what crossing that threshold would mean. And for me personally, it's meant that I would never want to get married ever. I only ever consider marriage the first kind of like 3 weeks of a relationship. And then I'm like, nah, no, no way, not for me. And similarly, having kids, like, I don't know. I'm glad I did it now when I'd had more therapy. But my fears remain the same because I'm this person. So it's just a case of dealing with them and rationalizing them and sort of putting them to bed when they arise.
But that's really interesting about that, how we theoretically divide our lives into two halves, because I think to argue the toss, I think I maybe had come at it from completely the other side of it to you.
Well, that's exciting. What do you mean?
Everyone had basically said to me that I was a 40-year-old trapped in 25-year-old's body. And I remember thinking, if I can just get through this bit where everyone wants to stay up very late and go to very sort of loud, smoky places and...
No one can knit.
And yeah, I remember, if I can just get through that, then I will reach this sort of halcyon place where I am a mum and I can do all these crafts that no one in my 20s gave a shit about will suddenly be quite useful.
Can I say, I did and thought they were incredibly cool.
Thank you. Yeah,
but I do agree. I understand what you're saying there. And I think that's really interesting. There's still this Rubicon to cross.
Yeah. Yeah. There's still this idea that one of them is sort of almost antithetical to the social expectations. Like I couldn't let slip in my 20s that what I really wanted was to make some bread and like do some singing and go for a long walk. I had to pretend, and I pretended really hard, that what I wanted to do was have meaningless sex on a bed with no sheet with someone who smelt of Elnett hairspray who would never ring me again, which, surprisingly enough, I didn't particularly enjoy and wasn't enormously good for my self-esteem.
Yeah, if they're not putting a sheet on the bed, you've got to disrespect them. We've all had our own version of this. Yeah, I completely agree. And I think to some extent I was like, wanted to feel like I was too melancholy and wouldn't ever settle down and it would not happen for me. And actually, I am so content and love having my daughter so much. And here's the thing as well, like, fear is so stupid because it's so... obscures the truth of things, which is so much better. Like, I was so frightened and I didn't say to myself, I remember my sister who'd had similar, we both held off having kids till our kind of mid-30s. And I think partly because we'd sort of come through some difficult times as kids. And she said to me, no one ever tells you how good it is. And no one ever tells you how lovely it is and how much you love them. And I think, it's interesting because I think my mum did want to communicate to us that a lot. And my mum was very, very loving with us. But I think it's funny, like, it never seemed to me like it would be a good thing. And I've had to see modelling of families and sort of win myself round to it and stuff.
Not to drag it onto the sort of tarnished ground of social media, but I do notice that if you talk about how much you love parenting or love your children, it will be sort of dismissed or maybe indulged by a few other people who feel the same. But if you talk about how hard it is, how unpleasant it is, what a dick your child is, what a mess they've made of your life, how your vagina is destroyed, all of those things, people lap it up. People absolutely love that stuff.
Yeah, I agree. That is the way so much stuff is. You know, it's the same with politics. If you tweet something about politics that's like, I feel so hopeful about this, that, the other, five people will like it. And if you tweet F the government, 1,000 people will share it. You know, like, it is what it is.
And the same reason that people don't talk about, like, you have a very shaky view of what a happy long-term relationship looks like, because people don't often talk about it. What we talk about is when to get out of a bad relationship, or like what it's like to be stuck in a shit relationship. We don't have people saying, this is what it, you know, this is how my relationship works after 15 years of being together. You don't hear it very often.
You don't hear people sharing nice things like that in the same way. That's why I do really like at the moment writing stand-up about cute and sweet moments with my daughter, because I find it so beautiful and so uplifting.
Are you comfortable talking a bit more about the second baby feeling?
Yeah, I'd love to. I've always wanted to have more than one kid. It took me a long time to sort of negotiate that. If it had been down to me, I would have tried to get pregnant when the baby was 3 months old. And even now I'm a bit like, I could have bashed them both out.
Mm-hmm.
Could have bashed them both out. But who knows how that would have been.
I was horny as the sun.
Me too.
About 2 weeks after my baby came out. And
so mum's a little bit late. Mum's about 3 months, but I was into it.
I think it was like raging need to feel loved and still like in myself and all that stuff. But also the hormones are like, do it again.
It's a funny thing. It's really hard because I feel the need so desperately. I don't know what it is. It's partly that I want my daughter to have a sibling. I really do. It's partly that I want to have a little gang. I really do. It's partly that before I had kids, I was like, oh, well, you know, maybe I have two. Now I've had them and I know what it's like. I wish I'd had them younger and could have 10. Like, I now look at, I've got a friend who's got about 7 siblings. And they're just such an amazing gang. They're just so great. And I've got some friends who are part of 4 siblings. And I know all the siblings, all 4 of them. They are such a bunch of legends. And they have such cute times together as a little group. And I just sort of would love to replicate that. But that's where I'm like, I've left it too late. And it's basically taken me 2 years to negotiate 1 to 2. So it's going to take me a long time.
I cannot put into words why I feel this need to have another baby. I can't really, I don't even know if there is a meaningful, rational argument for it. I don't think I can make my point with anecdote or statistic or anything. It's more that there's just this feeling that I have that I...
You just do.
I just want more. I want more. And I remember saying to my partner, I just, you know, he was like, it's like, I don't understand. You've got a cake. And why don't you just eat the cake? Why do you want another cake?
It's like somebody, you've never eaten a cake in your life, finally have one. You're like, oh, this is delicious. And they're like, that's no more for you. And you're like, but yeah, I didn't have any till I was 35. Like, I should have another one.
I'm the youngest of, I grew up with an older sister. So I'm also probably thinking, where's Nell? Mm-hmm. Like, I need to make the next one. I need to make the little one.
Yes, that is so
maybe perceptive. If I was an only child or the older sibling, I wouldn't have that feeling.
That is so perceptive. I've never thought of that. But when you said it, it was like a lightning bolt for me. Like, definitely. I've actually looked at my daughter and thought, oh, yeah, she's like my sister. I wonder what it's like for people who are number 5, what they do.
Are you radicalised? Do you think it's 5 or 0? I'm not going to mess around with 2.
Yeah, maybe. You think, I know what having a family is. It's bashing out 5.
My dad's the youngest of 6 and I know that he has a kind of like, well, why have 3 people at the dinner table when you can have 28? It's quite a nice, you know, it's quite a nice thing.
And also, I was thinking about this and I said this to my friend the other day, having children is a pyramid scheme. The more you have... the more blessings return to you.
Think of the people who are, in the case of me and my grandmother, think of the people who will willingly shave your face at 90 years old.
Oh.
It's lovely.
Yeah. I want to have a big crowd of children shaving my face.
Yeah.
I don't just want one solitary descendant.
I want them all to have their own tweezer and their own identified hair. And they'll come
round
every
week.
I want
them each to have their own spot. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, your cousin Betty was ever so good about my nose.
It's nice to talk to you about that. And it is tricky to talk about because if you're struggling to get pregnant for the first time, you probably don't want to hear someone talking about how sad they are that they can't have another baby. But it's also an sort of uncomfortable truth that sadness and grief is not a finite quantity, you know, finite resource.
And also,
we can all feel a bit of it and it doesn't take away anyone else's
feeling.
Right to feel it. You know, like if I'm sad that I can't have another baby, that doesn't mean someone who's trying desperately to have their first kid has to give me a bit of their sadness because I, you know, like they don't have to buck up and make everything okay so I have time to be sad. I just do feel a bit sad.
But also it's the same feeling.
Yeah.
Like it's the same feeling. We can understand each other better. Like I had worried in advance about my fertility. Then I got pregnant by accident, couldn't believe that, was so stunned, felt incredibly lucky, but as a result, I'm only yet going through a more normal attempt to have a baby and get pregnant.
When you say pregnant by accident, do you mean that you...
I was a virgin, I didn't even have it off.
Could it be the most beautiful chat in the world? Thank you so much to Josie Long for giving up her time like that and for being so brilliant and open and honest. Also, it was just nice to see her face again. Now, I sometimes think that having a human body is a little like being expected to drive a tractor without anyone ever explaining to you how it actually works. You're just set free with some heavy machinery, a load of manure, some seeds, and just sort of expected to do your best. Despite having a GCSE in biology, I knew relatively little about polycystic ovarian syndrome, menstrual health, what actually was going on up there, even into my adulthood. So I was thrilled when Dr. Anita Mitra, known as the Gynae Geek, agreed to come on the podcast to answer all my questions about bodies, cycles, and how to live healthily. I started by asking Dr. Mitra, for those of us who don't know personally, what exactly is polycystic ovarian syndrome?
Polycystic ovarian syndrome is often abbreviated to PCOS, or sometimes you see it called PCOD, so polycystic ovarian disease. But so what it is essentially a very common hormonal disorder where our bodies are not really producing the hormones that we need to encourage normal ovarian function in the proper way. Often we are making too much testosterone, and then this stops the ovaries from ovulating. And so then we find that people often have very irregular periods, or sometimes periods completely disappear and entirely. Right. So that's the first thing that you need to be able to identify someone with PCOS. So absent or irregular periods. Now, I mentioned about testosterone. So this is typically the male hormone. Now, women do need a little bit of testosterone, but it shouldn't be the predominant hormone. And so if you have PCOS, you often have signs of too much testosterone. So this can be classically things like quite oily skin, spots and acne. And then also male pattern baldness can also be another thing that people notice. The third thing is that when we do a scan, we see polycystic ovaries. So what this means is that we do an internal ultrasound scan usually to look at the ovaries, because it's the best way to get right close up to the action. And it means that we see all these tiny little sort of cysts on the ovaries. Now, it's really important to be clear that cysts are normal, because every month, if you are ovulating, you are releasing an egg within a cyst, so a fluid-filled sac. But if the ovaries are not getting the right signals from the hormones, it's still trying really hard to release these eggs, but it's not quite managing. So you've got all these kind of little immature eggs in little sacs waiting there. And so that gives this characteristic appearance on an ultrasound scan. And so we say if somebody has two of these things, then we can diagnose them with PCOS.
Mm. Gosh, that's so interesting. I think like... sometimes if I think about the fact that I have organs for very long, it makes me feel quite lightheaded. But it's also really comforting to know that this is, it's such a tiny tweak of hormones that makes this either functioning happily or functioning problematically. And that it's not a kind of black and white, there's something in your body that's gone wrong. This is just a sort of slight tweak of the normal biological function.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's really important that people are aware that it's not something they've done to themselves. I think that often when I talk to people who have PCOS, they say, oh, what have I done? You know, what's made this happen? But it's absolutely not your fault. And actually, our bodies are very clever in that everything has to be very tightly regulated. So it can just be one tiny little thing that happens. And then, you know, we find that lots of things happen as a result. And that may be that, you know, you're not ovulating, not having regular periods and starting to get these signs of too much male hormone.
I read on the NHS website that 1 in 10 people who get periods might have polycystic ovarian syndrome, but only half of those would show any symptoms.
I think it's really difficult to kind of really understand exactly how many people actually have PCOS, because some people can have PCOS and not really have any problems. For example, I think, you know, obviously getting pregnant is one of the things that it can cause problems with, but it's really important to be clear that not everybody with PCOS is going to struggle to get pregnant. And the other thing is that I think often PCOS can be overdiagnosed, because it's really important to say that just simply having a scan that shows that you've got polycystic ovaries does not mean that you have polycystic ovarian syndrome. So particularly when you're very young, you've got loads of eggs that are all busting to get out. And so the ovaries can look, you know, I always say the word juicy. I'm not sure if that's the right word, but
I love it.
There's loads of eggs there. There's lots of little follicles. And so if you have that appearance on a scan and you don't have problems with your periods, you don't have acne or male pattern baldness, for example, then you don't have PCOS. You just have lots of eggs that are trying to get out. And so I think it can be overdiagnosed. And that in itself causes a lot of anxiety.
In the same way your physical and mental health need regular upkeep, what would you say were our sort of key pointers for menstrual health?
So if you're not using hormonal contraception, then you should ideally be having a period approximately every month. So we say anything from 21 to 35 days is normal. So when I'm talking about the number of days, I'm talking about the number of days from the start of one period to the start of the next period. Anything where you're outside of that, or you just really can't predict when your period's going to come, then that's not entirely normal. And then also thinking about pain. Now, it is normal to have a little bit of pain when you have your period, and it's not unusual to need to take some painkillers, for example, on the first day or so. But it shouldn't be at the point where you absolutely can't do the things that you need to do. For example, go to work, or, you know, go out and get your shopping, look after your children. Or if you're clock watching, thinking, gosh, when can I take the next painkiller? And the other thing is about how heavy your period is. So I think it's really difficult to give a number. The textbooks always say more than 80 mils. But, you know, let's be honest, who sits over a jug when they have their period?
You've just given me a flashback to, I think when I was young, on the side of tampons, it talked about tablespoons full. And like, what an image that is.
Exactly. The best definition of something that's heavy is where you are just changing your pads, tampons, cups all the time. And it's just too much for you to handle. So it's all about the person. What can you tolerate? What can you handle? Because what might be quite heavy for one person might be fine for another person. And also, is it making you anemic? So is it making your hemoglobin levels too low? Right. So these are kind of the three key signs, I would say, when it comes to periods. So how often are you having one? How heavy is it? How painful is it?
Just to return to PCOS, we struggle to then think about treatment. Is the sort of treatment a kind of more holistic approach, like you have to, your diet, exercise regime is going to play a part in it? Or are there more sort of invasive treatments that people can turn to?
So, I mean, obviously, I'm a doctor. I am trained to prescribe medication, perform surgery, that kind of thing. But I'm very much a fan of taking a very holistic approach. In every guideline all around the world that's ever been written about PCOS, the first line is always about lifestyle. And so this is something that I absolutely love to talk to people about. And it's not all about just eating kale and broccoli. So I think it's really important that, you know, we all understand that there's not one specific diet for PCOS, or in fact, any kind of gynecological health problem. It's all about a diet that gives you all of the kind of nutrients that the body needs to function, because it's so important to remember that your ovaries are not functioning on their own. All our body systems are very much joined up. I don't really like the word diet, but the Mediterranean style way of eating, I think, is just the way forward. I think there's a lot of fear mongering when it comes to sugar, when it comes to PCOS, because of the fact that, you know, if we want to go really deep down into the chemical basis of it, it often happens because there's a degree of what we call insulin resistance. Mm. So it's kind of almost a bit like a pre-diabetic state. Now, I don't think that everybody needs to cut out sugar from their diet. But again, it's all about in moderation. And so when you're thinking about carbohydrates, making sure that you're having more quality over quantity. There's no evidence to show that gluten or dairy are going to worsen PCOS. But some people might say, for example, well, actually, you know, dairy makes my acne worse. So that's great if you found something that you can correct. But if you're cutting these things out of your diet, do think about touching base with a nutrition professional, because, for example, dairy is a great source of calcium and vitamin D and iodine, that all things that we need for the body. But if you're cutting these things out and they're not helping, then I wouldn't continue, because these diets can be quite restrictive and it's quite psychologically challenging. I think also sleep hygiene is massive. If you're not sleeping, then that has an impact on your hormones, because, you know, brain senses them, sends signals all over the body to the adrenal glands, ovaries, all these places. And I think the other thing is about exercise. Now, it's just really important to, you know, make sure that we're doing some form of exercise. And again, I wouldn't say there's one best exercise, whatever you like, something that, you know, you enjoy that allows you to move your body and also just take time out of, you know, other parts of life that are quite stressful. So I do, in my book, I have four chapters that are dedicated to lifestyle. And it just, you know, talks about all the kind of topics that I would discuss with a patient. I think the other thing to mention is that there are medications that we can use when we are treating people who do have PCOS. There's also medications that we can use to help people in terms of helping their bodies to ovulate, so to release an egg. Now, we also often talk about the contraceptive pill with PCOS, and often people are a bit concerned about this. Just to say, I have no conflict of interest. I'm not paid by any pill company or any pharmaceutical company. So, you know, I just want the best for the patient. And so I think that we're often scared about the pill because there's lots of bad things written about it. But there are some good things about the pill. And I think everyone deserves to have the correct information. And so what I would say is that when we use the pill in PCOS, we're doing it not to kickstart the hormones, not to regulate the hormones. We're doing it because you're not having a regular bleed. And we want you to have a bleed, we say once a season, so approximately four times a year, because we know that if you're not bleeding with that frequency, you may end up with a thickened lining of the endometrium, the lining of the womb, and that can become abnormal. And when I say abnormal, I mean we're talking about precancerous and potentially cancerous changes in the lining. Right. So that's why it's so important that we are helping you to have a bleed, because some people will say, oh gosh, I maybe have two periods a year. And that's when we become a little bit concerned.
Okay.
So when you're having a bleed because we're giving hormones, it's not because your body's kickstarted. It's because the medication that we've given has helped you to shed that lining. So when you stop taking the pill, you will still probably have irregular periods. So it's not going to sort of treat things for the long term. But I think it is important to just have that thought when it comes to safety netting. But it's completely up to you. You don't have to feel forced that you have to take the pill. There's also a lot of talk about the pill sort of masking PCOS. And I think that it's really important to say that we're not using the pill to mask symptoms. We're using it to try and reduce the symptoms that you might have, because the pill can also help with the acne that people get. And so I think that it's really important to just reinforce that everyone deserves to have their symptoms treated if they want to. But also we do sometimes find that people, for example, maybe have been on the pill since they were a teenager, and then they come off because they're wanting to get pregnant and they find that their periods are irregular. And it may be that actually they did have PCOS, maybe didn't recognize it as a teenager. And so it's not the pill that's caused the periods to become irregular. It's just the fact that you may well have had this underlying PCOS that you maybe didn't know about. And so I think it's just really important to be honest and clear about that, because people are worried about taking the pill. And also just to reinforce that there isn't ever a case of being on the pill for too long. There's no time limit. It's not going to have an impact on your fertility because you've been on it for a long time, for example. But I do fully acknowledge that, yes, you may have an underlying problem when it comes to PCOS because you've been having the pill for that duration of time. And during that time, you were having regular periods because the pill was making your body have those regular bleeds, if that makes sense.
One other thing I wanted to pick your brains about while you're here is how these things are affected by the 35-year deadline. That I knew so many women who had in their head the idea that after 35, something chronic was like something with basically their uterus would fall down dead and slip out of their body, and that was it. And I just sort of wanted to talk to you about whether that is true, right, whether those fears are founded, or whether we need to sort of hang up the idea of 35 as the be all and end all.
Yeah, definitely. I think that also from an anecdotal point of view, being a very similar age to you, I know that there's so many people at the moment who think that. And I think it starts when you sort of turn 30, actually.
Completely.
I think it's just so important to be really honest that fertility does decline with age. And I did a post about this a while ago, and some people were a bit upset saying, well, you know, I had a baby at 40 and I didn't struggle to get pregnant. And I think it's just really important to say that, sure, yes, doesn't mean that automatically after 30, you're going to struggle to get pregnant. Now, the Office for National Statistics has statistics on the age of mothers, and the most recent ones are from 2019. And we know that over 50% of mothers in 2019 were over 30. And in fact, 5% were over 40. Now, it doesn't tell you about how easy it was for them to get pregnant, but I think that's just a really a good reminder of the fact that it is totally possible to have a child after that age. Now, the reason that fertility declines with age is related to the fact that the number of eggs declines and the quality of those eggs declines. But it's so important to mention that it's not just about eggs when we're getting pregnant.
Eggs don't make babies on their own.
Exactly. We need them to be released. We need them to be able to travel through the tube, okay? And we need them to be able to implant in a nice lining. But we also need healthy sperm. It's so important. It's not just about you. You know, so we say that when we talk about problems with fertility, 30% are attributed to male factor, 30% female factor, and 30% are unknown, but probably, again, 50-50 between the two. So ultimately, it takes two to tango. It's totally 50-50. I think a lot of people start to think, gosh, I need to test my fertility now. But, you know, I think that's just so important to remember that there are tests that you can do for fertility, and there are some caveats to them. And now I'm kind of going, it's a little bit off topic, but any kind of test of your fertility only tells you what is happening at that very moment and doesn't tell you anything else about what's going on with your partner.
From the age of about 16 or 17, when I became sexually active, all the discourse was about female bodies making babies, and it completely negated the fact that there were also sperm involved. It's just wild.
Yeah, definitely. And when I've been in the fertility clinic, seeing somebody for the first time who's coming with fertility issues, then, you know, obviously I'll talk to the female partner, but then I turn to the male and they often look at me like, oh, sorry, what do I have to do with this? You're a gynecologist. Well, I may be, but I do know that you do have a role.
Hello, welcome back. And thank you for listening right to the end. I'm sitting on a tree stump, enjoying the smell of cherry blossom and trying very hard not to be mistaken for a bin. Thank you so much to Josie Long and Dr. Anita Mitra for giving up their time and their wisdom. Thank you to my producer, Rich Jarman, for making this whole thing happen. And most of all, thank you to you for listening. Next week's show is a bit of a counterpoint to Sarah Pascoe's explanation of why she hates weddings. Because on Friday, I'll be talking to a woman who loves weddings so much, she got married twice to the same man. That's right, I'll be talking to the brilliant Sian Harries, co-writer of Channel 4's Man Down, co-host of The Froth with Rod Gilbert, and one of my very favourite Welsh women in the whole world. So please come back next week to hear that. If you've enjoyed this podcast, and actually even if you haven't, please subscribe and leave me a glowing 5-star review so more people can find it. There are many things in this life that are free, but frankly, leaving a podcast review is one of the best.
Is a brand new audio production.